Okay, welcome. This is the 23rd class of the Derech Hashem series, May 7th, the 30th of the Omer, 15th of the Iyar, 5772. Tonight we're in the second section, in the third chapter, and we're up to the eighth paragraph. Now, when I say paragraph, of course, in this particular case, I mean four pages, because that's just how the Ramchal numbered it, but that's how you can find it. So we're about to approach a pretty difficult idea. We're in the section on Hashgacha Pratis. He calls it Hashgacha Ha'ishit, Hashgacha Ha'ishis, but really individual providence. So we're learning a few different concepts in that, but this one is a particularly challenging one for us, and he doesn't actually address it in the context in which I found it personally challenging. You'll see what I mean as we go into it. Okay, so this section, so tonight hopefully we're going to get through 8 and 9 only. 8 is very long. Okay, so we've discussed different types of hashgacha so far and how it affects us in the two previous classes, three, I think we've been on this chapter. So this is an additional concept that stems from, I'm going to read some of his words inside. It stems from both the individual and general aspects of providence discussed earlier. Okay, I'll start by reading inside. In English, when the highest wisdom considered everything needed to rectify the human race and make it into the perfected community discussed earlier, it saw that this goal would be furthered if some people could benefit others and help them attain a place in this community. Okay, so far we've just discussed our own personal role in creating our own personal chalak in Olam Haba. So we know that all Jews have a chalak in Olam Haba. They can do things to lose that chalak. All non-Jews can do things to earn a chalak. So, but all Jews are born with a chalak in Olam Haba. How is that possible? When we understand Olam Haba, as we do so far, our understanding is to the point where we know that what we're creating in this world is a relationship with Hashem. And it's in that relationship that we live in the next world. So we've used a mashal before of a cruise ship, and the quality of the cruise is directly dependent on the quality of the relationship that you're sharing the cruise with that person. So, and that's really what Olam Haba is. This is the place for us to develop the relationship, and that's the place for us to live in that relationship. So within that framework, it would be quite challenging for us to think about how other people could help us develop our share in Olam Haba. Right? Does that make sense as a question so far?
Yeah.
Everybody can pipe in. So, right. So we have this concept of individually working on developing our own Olam Haba. And the previous part of the chapter discussed how, you know, the choices that we make and the behaviors that we engage in and refrain from build that relationship, build that chalak that we have. But now we're going to enter into a completely different realm. Okay, back to the text. The rule that the community of the future world be restricted only to those who attain perfection in their own right is therefore not absolute. For it was decreed that an individual can reach a level where he can partake of perfection and be included in this community as the result of his association with a more worthy individual. The only difference is that he will remain on the lower level since he's not included in the community in his own right, but only through association with another. Okay, so now we have this concept that it's possible through association with someone to enter into the perfected community, even if you didn't earn it yourself. So in a way, there's a secondary process of earning a chalak in Olam Haba, and that is by association with another. I think about this personally. I think about this frequently just in terms of my own family's participation in my life, that as Gentiles, they can earn a chalak in Olam Haba when they support a Jewish life. And I think about the different chosim also. Like, for instance, my grandmother, who was a very strong Christian, she did give me money for my education, which she meant for college, which I ended up using to be able to go to Israel and learn yeshiva for a few years. So in a way, we're all benefiting from the money that she set aside, that she gifted me with, for me to learn in Eretz Israel. So what chos did she have to give that money? And what chus does she get from having given that money through her association to all of us in a way, because all of us benefit from that money that she gifted. So there is a possibility of gaining a level of schus through facilitating the life of another, but also through association. So in a way, through whether it's friendship, or in today's terms, we might understand it in a Hasidish way, although the Ramchal writes before Hasidism. So he's not writing about a Rebbe-Talmud relationship in the classic sense that we understand it today, of being attached to a Rebbe. But he does sort of mean that type of a relationship, that by attaching oneself to a tzaddik or to somebody above you, that person can bring you along in their wake, so to speak. So as they make progress spiritually through our attachment to that person, we can be carried along in their coattails. So that would be a second pathway of achieving a chelek, although if we achieve it through that pathway, then our level remains lower because we didn't achieve it through our own right, but just through association. Any questions on that so far as we continue deeper into this?
That's good.
Okay. Back to the text. The only ones who are cast aside completely from perfection, therefore, are those who are not worthy of it at all, neither through their own merit nor through association with another. Because of this, the number who are saved from annihilation and allowed this ultimate bliss is maximized. Okay, so those who cause others to partake in the world to come will, this is slightly, I want to paraphrase a little bit, are the ones who will have the primary positions in Olam Haba, and those who are connected to them will have secondary positions. The way that this works then, the principle through which this functions, is Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Leze. All Israel is responsible one for another. Okay, so that's the English translation. All Israel are responsible for one another. But let's just look at that word in Hebrew here, Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Leze. So Arev can be translated in a few different ways. So definitely can be translated here as responsible one for another. It can also be translated, and Arev is also a guarantor, somebody who signs for you for a loan. So if you default on the loan, they'll pay it back. That person is called an Arev. So that they are connected to you, they back you up. That's an Arev. It's the same word also as Erev, evening. And the same word, it's the same root also as mix, a mixture. Le'arbev is to mix something up. Irbuvia is something that's a mixed up thing. And if you think about evening, even in English, evening is the mixing of two. But evening is when day mixes with night, that in-between zone. Hang on, somebody else is joining us live. Okay, we're here in this section. You can find your place. Different page number now. So it can mean evening, the mixing of day and nighttime, but it can mean mixed in. So in this case, rather than translating it, all Israel are responsible one for another, I rather translate it as all Israel is deeply connected one to another, inextricably interwoven one with another. So that's really the way that this works. And if we understand that that's the concept, then we can understand how this principle works a little bit, and we'll see that it's going to go even further. So what this means is that all Jews are totally connected at their spiritual root one with another. So we're nourished from the same source, so our roots are the same, but then we flower differently. And I think I've used before the mushel of a mum plant, right? So anybody who's, when I was a new bride and bought mums and thought that I would divide them up on my walkway because it's a nice bushy plant, and I'd be able to like divide it into quarters and plant it along the walkway, I was quite surprised when I reached down to the bottom of it after I got it home and found that there was one stick holding 300 blossoms, and I couldn't divide it up at all. So really that's like the Jewish people. It's one root, but all of us blossom individually. So we all look like separate blossoms, but really we're all connected in the deepest place all together, which means that what you do to one affects another, and what one does affects another. So first of all, as Makarvot, that's the first principle here, is that we do all affect one another. And so for that, we want to help other Jews do what's best for them, not just because on the top level, because we love each other, hopefully, So we want to reach out to each other and help each other have the best life possible, which is connected to Torah. But really, even in a deeper way, a selfish way, and then an even deeper way. So there's three reasons why we do Kiruv. A, we love each other. We want to help each other connect into the deepest life possible. B, we're selfish. We want Klal Yisrael to be as successful as possible, and Klal Yisrael can't be successful without each one of us doing what we're supposed to be doing because we're all interconnected to one another. So if one person's slacking, everybody else hurts from it. And if each person is pulling properly, everybody benefits from it. And the mushal that's used regularly in the Sifrei Kodesh for that is the mushal of a boat, right? So if there's 100 people rowing in a boat, and one person decides to drill a hole under their seat, well, and everybody else starts to object and say, you can't drill a hole under your seat. And the person who stopped rowing for a minute, so first of all, they stopped rowing, they're not pulling their weight, but then they started drilling, says, what do you mean I can't drill a hole? It's my seat. I could drill a hole under my seat if I want. But of course, as you know, in a boat, that's not possible because everybody sinks when one person drills a hole. So not only is everybody harmed by the one person stopping to pull their weight in the rowing, but everybody's harmed even more so by them drilling a hole. So when people aren't doing mitzvahs, they're not pulling their weight. But when people are doing averas, they're drilling holes. So we want to try to plug the holes and help people pull their weight, help people contribute to the klal as much as possible. So that's level two, why we do kiruv, because we want to get everybody on board pulling in the same direction. But level three is deeper still, and that's really the love of Hashem. That we love Hashem and we know that Hashem, that Hashem's plan will be made manifest when we get everybody to do what they're supposed to be doing. So for that reason, we want to reach out and bring everybody in because you can't have Klal Yisrael without everybody together. We're all supposed to be one group together. That Eliyahu Kitov speaks about that at the Arba Minim, the four species, bringing the Lulav, the Etrog, the Hadassim, and the Aravos together. That they represent the four different types of Jews, and that the Esrog represents the Jew that has both taste and smell. The Esrog has taste and smell. So the Jew that has Torah has a good taste, and the Jew that has Masim Tovim, good deeds, has a good smell. So the Esrog represents the Jews who have Torah and good deeds. The Lulav is a date palm. That has a taste, has dates, but no smell. So that represents Jews who have Torah, but no Masim Tovim, no good deeds. The Aravos, wait, the Hadassim, have a good smell, but no fruit. They have no taste at all. So that represents Jews who have Masim Tovim, but no Torah. And the Aravos have no taste and no smell. That represents Jews who have no Torah and no good deeds. And yet the mitzvah can't be done without bringing all four groups together. We have to be one united Klal Yisrael, one united nation. So, and that's what Hashem wants, is for us all to be together. So that's the deepest reason that we do Kiruv, is to bring us all together. But it's because of that connection at the root. Okay, that being set up then, that concept of our total connection one to another, so we can first see the initial thing that he's discussing here, that one person could assist another through that connection to bring that second person into Olam Haba. So even if the second person is of lesser stature, hasn't really accomplished very much on their own, but they do attach themselves to somebody of higher stature, that person of higher stature can drag them along into Olam Haba. But now we get into the much more difficult part. Any questions on this so far before we get more difficult?
Nope.
Okay, I have a question here. What's your question?
The third one was the third level. No taste, but the
yes,
smell.
The smell. Yes.
Okay.
Taste, smell. No taste, no smell, no taste or smell. Okay, because I'm not too late. Okay. Now we're going to go more deeply. Okay, so with that understanding, we go to the next paragraph, which I'll read inside. As a result of this principle, suffering and pain may be imposed on a tzaddik as an atonement for his entire generation. This tzaddik must then accept this suffering with love for the benefit of his generation, just as he accepts the suffering imposed upon him for his own sake. In doing so, he benefits his generation by atoning for it, and at the same time is himself elevated to a very great degree. For a tzaddik such as this is made into one of the leaders in the community of the future world, as discussed earlier. So Such suffering also includes cases where a tzaddik suffers because his entire generation deserves great punishments, bordering on annihilation, but is spared via the tzaddik's suffering. In atoning for his generation through his suffering, the tzaddik saves these people in this world and also greatly benefits them in the world to come. So you might see why this is a troubling passage. At least I felt it was, because I didn't understand that we Jews have a concept of one person suffering for the atonement of others. But we do have such a concept, and I worked on this very much. I spoke to Rabbi Rieti about it at length and others the first few times I taught the Sefer. But this is a deep Jewishly rooted concept which has been taken and bastardized by other religions. But we do definitely have a concept of a tzaddik being able to suffer for the sake of others. So, and sometimes we see that in a community. Of course, you can never tell exactly, but it sure seemed to me, and that's just me in my smallness, but we have a very strong couple here in Denver who were, they're both really very pure, very clear, very community-centered. He's a member of the Kollel and works, you know, very strongly for the community and in Kiruv, and she's very Tehora V'Kedosha. And one morning they woke up and their two-year-old, their, I think, number five child, had a cough and a fever, and it just got a little bit worse. They took her to the doctor, and within 2 hours she was dead. Just up and died. Like, no forewarning, no nothing. She just died. And they buried her just a few hours later. And on her tombstone, it says, Niktasa v'nikbara. She was snatched and buried. They asked the Shiloh of what to write on the tombstone because you can't really, I mean, what kind of a eulogy can you give for a two-year-old? What have they accomplished? Except for, you can understand on a deeper level that they must have accomplished what they needed to accomplish coming into this world. In those 2 years, they accomplished it. And the interaction that they had with their parents, with their siblings, helped their parents and siblings accomplish what they needed to accomplish through her life and through her death. But if we understand that we very often, not always, but often suffer because of sins that we've committed, whether it's in this life or in others, it would be difficult to see how a couple like that could have, I mean, when you see them, they're shining, could have done enough to merit such a horrible punishment. But you could see how a couple like that, who are so supportive of the community, could have worked on themselves enough that they could bear such a punishment for the sake of the community. That would be possible to see. Again, I'm not saying that's for sure what happened, because we can never, Hashem is the one in charge of seeing things like that, knowing things, causing things like that. But we could, in light of this, understand how a couple like that, and they bore it so with such majesty that it was really incredible to the entire community to watch them in the Shiva and in the time that followed, what it was like for them and how they handled themselves spiritually and personally with everyone around. To me, it just seemed like such an example of tzaddikim bearing suffering for the sake of others, whatever, whether it's the community or doesn't even have to be a direct community. It could be a wider city community. It could be a generation, in the generation, or wherever they are. But there are certain people who can handle suffering for the sake of others. So moving back just a second, and not really back, but sideways for a minute, we have a Mamar al-Chazal that says, and I'll translate it, but first I'll say it in Hebrew, Ha'alu ve'eino ne'alav, Shomea cherpato ve'eino mashiv, Mekabel yisurin ba'ahava, the one who is insulted and yet doesn't take insult, doesn't become insulted. The one who hears his cherpa, however you want to translate that, insult, embarrassment, shame, and doesn't answer, doesn't reply. The one who receives suffering or accepts suffering with love, that person is like the sun that shines in its zenith. So these three things are all considered a very high level. What I want to focus on here is the accepting suffering with love. So the concept of accepting suffering with love is not an easy concept. I mean, it's one thing to bear suffering, which is a level that we could strive towards, but to actually accept it with love is a higher level than just accepting it. Rather than just saying Gamzula Tova, which again is something that we can strive towards, we could get to a Gamzula Tova aspect. This too is for the best. A really level above that, or a few levels above that, is to accept it with love, to understand that it's absolutely designed for our betterment, and that even the suffering is an act of love by Hashem, and that we accept it with love. We appreciate it. So we feel the love when we feel the suffering, and we appreciate the fact that we've had that opportunity to become spiritually rectified, to change the shape of our kli, of our vessel, through that process of suffering. So somebody who's come to that, the more one shapes themselves, the more one stretches themselves, the bigger a kli they can build through their own behavior and also through the suffering that they engage in, and there's many different levels to engage in it, just to have it wash over you, or to actually step into it, or to step into it with love and accept it, to accept it with love. So there's a whole spectrum of dealing with suffering, but that also shapes one's kli, one's vessel of who they are. But the way that we engage in the world, the way that we refrain from the world, and the way that we experience suffering all shapes who we are and tunes us to be able to engage in the world differently because of what we've accomplished through our engagement, our refraining, and our suffering. So when we can engage in all those things, those three things, right, positive engagement, so that's mitzvot aseh, then the refraining, that's mitzvot lo taseh, and then the suffering, for the many reasons that there is suffering, all those three things together combine to make us who we are, to make us a spiritual kalim that we are, and then we're able to experience the world differently through the new kli that we become on a regular basis. So we're constantly evolving to be able to experience the world differently, but also then to be able to influence the world differently, which I guess is not the point of this right here, but we will see the difference that it makes. It is for the, I guess it is also the point here. Let's just go a little further. Let's see. Okay. A few paragraphs down in English. Okay, individuals such as these, however, are themselves perfect to the extent that a human being can be perfect, and therefore worthy only of good. This is one answer to why tzaddik viralo, when people ask that question, why should a righteous person suffer? This is one answer. Another answer, of course, being who are we to know who's righteous and who do we know what's ra for a person, what's bad? We can't necessarily know, but there are some people who are tzaddikim who do experience bad, and it's not because they deserve it. It's because they can handle it for others. So back to the text, the only reason they suffer is because of others, and the attribute of justice must therefore be as satisfied with a small amount of suffering on their part as with a large amount on the part of those who actually sinned. Beyond that, the merit and power of these tzaddikim is also increased because of such suffering. So this is the principle I was just discussing before. So the merit and power of these tzaddikim is also increased because of such suffering, and this gives them even greater ability to rectify the damage of others. They can therefore not only rectify their own generation, but wait till you hear this, but can also correct all the spiritual damage done from the beginning, from the time of the very first sinners. It is obvious that individuals such as these will ultimately be the foremost leaders in the perfected community and the ones who are the very closest to God. Okay, so let me just stop here and see if you have any questions before I continue with thoughts about this.
If that's the case, then why hasn't Mashiach come yet? Like, there's been enough great people.
Right. Excellent question. So the question is, if that's the case, why hasn't Mashiach come yet? There's been so many great people. You would think that there have been enough tzaddikim who've been able to carry enough suffering to rectify all the damage that's been done in the world. Right. So that's an excellent question. Of course, I can't answer that question. But that being said, which I can't answer it, I could just venture some thoughts and guesses. So I think while it's possible to rectify what's happened before, there's still things going on now. But apart from that, there's accomplishment. So there's one thing is rectification, but another thing is accomplishing what we're supposed to accomplish, actually continuing to flower. So there's the tikkun that has to happen, the repair that has to happen from earliest times until now, but there's also the continued development of humanity as a whole, and Jews specifically, before the world can be brought to its right place. So tikkun olam really is only bringing rectification where really we want to get back to zero, which is where Adam and Chava started, right? At just that equilibrium, that point of perfect balance where they could freely choose between good and evil without being pushed in either direction or pulled in either direction by anything outside of them, that it would be a total balance. So they were at that place of perfect balance when they made that first decision to behave incorrectly, and that completely changed the reality in which we live, which was discussed earlier in the class, but totally changed everything, changed our physical reality, the bodies that we live in, the world that we inhabit, how everything works was completely changed by that initial decision. So that is an aspect of the breaking of the world that we're trying to fix, right? So tikkun olam refers to fixing the damage that was caused by that, and then the continuing damage, although that was such a huge damage that really no damage that we do now can compare to that damage, but we continued to rip the fabric. But they created such a huge hole that it really takes a lot to heal it. So there's that fixing that has to happen. But in addition to the fixing, there's the achievement that has to happen. So if we can fix everything and get back to zero, if we can go from negative 49 levels of tuma back up to zero, that's great. We've achieved tremendous strides spiritually, but we only got back to zero. And really what we have to do is get up to, just using the spirit of Omer Mashal, since we're in that time period right now, we have to get up to 49 so we can go to transcendence, so which is 50. So like what we're doing right now during Spheres of Omer, where we are simultaneously, each day that we count, we're repairing the damage of the level below us and fixing that level above us. So too are we doing that in the world. Before I continue with that, does everybody know what I'm talking about in terms of Spheres of Omer, the fixing the damage below and the repairing the damage above? Okay, let me explain that a little bit. So while we were in Egypt, while we were in Mitzrayim, we sank to the 49th level of Tumah. So everybody's familiar with that statement, whatever that means. Sank to the 49th level of Tumah. And we all know also that if we would have hit number 50, there would have been nothing left to redeem. So what does that mean exactly? What is 49? And why are we counting 49 levels? So we talked about Pesach. Part of Pesach is leaping up. What it was passed over, of course, is the Jewish houses, but really the deeper aspect of what was passed over for Pesach was the prerequisites for redemption, that we were redeemed even though we didn't deserve it. So we were brought up to a very high level. Even though we had not earned it, we were redeemed because of the promise of Hashem to Abraham that he's going to bring us into Mitzrayim and take us out. So we were redeemed because of the promise, not because we earned it. Really what happened is as a nation, we sank to the 49th level of Tumah. So what is 49? 49 is 7 times 7. 7 is the number of nature. That's 7 days in the week and 7 colors in the rainbow, 7 notes in the Western scale of music, not in all scales of music, but 7 is a number of nature, of wholeness and completion. And in 7, there's really 7 aspects to a cube, even the 6 outside sides, and then the internal energy that brings it together, the inside, number 7. And the days of the week are like that, 6 outside days and 1 Shabbos day, the internal spiritual energy that holds it all together. And the number 7 in Hebrew is Sheva. If you take the dot of the shin and put it on the other side, you get Sova, wholeness or completion, right? It's the same root as like the Achalta, the Savata, uverachta, you're satisfied. So seven means whole or complete. So seven, and seven represents nature. It's the fullness of nature, which is why we do a bris milah on the eighth day. Bris milah is above, the bris milah brings you into the covenant with Hashem. And it's done on the eighth day because eight is the realm of the neshama. Shmona, the number shmona. If you rearrange the letters, you get neshama. So eight is the realm of above nature. So seven times seven is nature, sheba nature. The most intense form of nature possible is seven times seven. That's 49. And one above that is 50. That's total transcendence. 50 is like a super number eight. It's absolutely transcending all the sevens. So the number 50 is complete transcendence, not just an eight, not just the realm of the soul, but transcendence from that, all those levels, all impacting one on another. So if we would have hit the level 50 of Tuma, we would have been totally annihilated. There would have been nothing left to redeem. Literally, if we would have gone one step lower, we would have been completely finished. The whole world would have reverted to tohu vavohu. So, and in the same sense, right now we're counting the Omer, we're going up 49 levels so that we can receive the Torah on day 50, that day of super transcendence, the day we receive the mission from Hashem that brings us the whole world, eventually, it's the beginning of bringing the whole world to its ultimate perfection. So that has to be a completely above and beyond nature. So now we have two sets of 49. We have from zero down to negative 49, and we have from zero up to positive 49. So negative 50 is total annihilation, and positive 50 is receiving the Torah. So right now during Sefirot HaOmer, we count 49 days from coming out of Mitzrayim to receiving the Torah, and each day that we count has a spiritual double task. So task number one, they could be, I mean, it's not that they take priority. They are working simultaneously. So if we understand Pesach passed over our prerequisites and we were redeemed, we were whisked to a high level, placed on a high level, and now from Pesach until Sefirot HaOmer, we have to build the platform under the spiritual level that we achieved. So that's from zero to plus 49. We are building the steps up to create the foundation for the level to which we were whisked by Hashem on Seder night. But also at the same time, we have to repair the damage that was done below. So each day, today is the 30th for me anyway, I'm still in zone 30. So today is about building level 30 and repairing level negative 30. So I'm doing both at the same time. So repair is one thing and building is another. So the suffering of tzaddikim repairs, but I'm not sure how much it builds. It builds the kli of the individual and creates their strength and the ability to do reparation and to bring others along with them. But, and here is where the conjecture starts, I'm not clear on how much it builds because we also have to build. Humanity has to be built. And that's why each generation has its own challenge that we face. Right? Each generation has to come to terms with its own ability. So we all have different a different environment in which we have to keep Torah and mitzvot. So our challenge is completely different of the challenge of any other generation. Previous generations had to deal with, some had to deal with extreme poverty. Some had to deal with incredible illness. Some had to deal with incredible anti-Semitism. Some had to deal with terrible destruction. Some had to deal with horrible displacement. We currently, today, we Western English-speaking Jews live in extreme comfort and extreme wealth, even if we're not wealthy compared to our neighbors. I mean, our bellies are full and our closets are stuffed and our houses are climate-controlled and comfortable. Whatever. I mean, we live like beyond the wildest dreams of Azar 150 years ago. You know, we live way beyond that level, where we have fruits flown in from around the world, grapes from Chile and clementines year-round, whatever you want. It's unbelievable the way that we live. So how do we serve Hashem through wealth? How do we serve Hashem through plenty? And how do we serve Hashem through so much distraction? No Jew ever lived in a generation where we were distracted by so many devices and so many things pulling our attention all the time. So it's our unique opportunity to build a connection with Hashem through this model, in this framework, in a way that the Chafetz Chaim never could have built a relationship. He can't build the relationship. He couldn't have built the relationship that we could build. It's not possible because he didn't face the challenges that we face. So there's a level of building that also has to occur. So in thinking about who we are as a people, right, we're supposed to be a goy kadosh v'mamlechet kohanim, right? Mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. So we're supposed to be a holy nation and a nation of kohanim, a nation of priests, right? So what does that mean? We have a kohanic class, but we're supposed to be a home mamlechet kohanim, each and every one of us, male and female, kohen, Levi, Yisrael, all of us are supposed to be kohanim, which means that all of us are supposed to lead. The kohen's job is to connect the average Jew with Hashem. And as a kohanic nation, it would be each and every one of our jobs to connect the average human with the divine. So really, the Jewish people are supposed to grow into the clergy class of the world. We're not there yet. We haven't achieved it yet. So I think Mashiach didn't come yet because we haven't yet grown to the place. We haven't yet achieved what we're supposed to achieve. So it's one thing to be metaken the negative, but it's another thing to achieve the positive, to grow into, to mature into the people that we're supposed to be, to accomplish what needs to be accomplished in this world. So every generation has its own task to accomplish, and it seems that we just haven't finished accomplishing yet. It's all added together. But until enough has been accomplished, it's not yet time for Mashiach to arrive. Does that help answer that question?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Okay. Anything else before we continue just to drop? Okay. I want to read number 9. All this is not only the result of justice, but also follows from the actual order of things as discussed earlier. As a result of man's sins, corruption is increased and incorporated into both man and the world. This in turn causes God's light to be increasingly retracted and hidden. The more this corruption is cleansed, on the other hand, and the more people are purified of it, the more God's light is once again revealed, step by step. Suffering is the thing that God created to cleanse this pollution, both in general and in particular. Thus, through the suffering of these select individuals, creation in general is cleansed, and step by step, the world is brought closer to perfection. Okay, so that's this principle, is that we see here that what he's saying is that this is not necessarily an aberration of nature, but this does actually, this concept of the ability to connect one to another and for one to be able to suffer for the sake of others is actually following the principles that Hashem set up, that what happens is that as we incorporate, as we grow in positive directions, and as we incorporate goodness into us by proactively behaving positively, and as we protect ourselves by avoiding the negative, we actually increase Kedusha and Tahara in the world. And the opposite is also the case. When we engage in negative things, we actually increase negativity in the world. The way negativity is increased is by increasing the Hesterpanim of Hashem, by increasing the concealment of Hashem. So when we do negative things, Hashem made us in his image, and part of Hashem's image is that Hashem's a creator. So Hashem, in making us in Hashem's image, Hashem gave us the power to create, and the opposite, we can also destroy. So when we behave in negative ways and incorporate negativity into ourselves through our behavior, that has an effect on the whole world, and it brings negativity into the world. The negativity that's brought is Hashem's additional concealment. We create, we create like a thicker veil that Hashem can't, of course he can, but chooses not to shine through that veil. He has given power into our hands for us to weave thicker veils by behaving negatively, or for us to thin them out, pull threads out eventually until the light can shine through tshuva or through suffering. So it's up to us. So it seems that tzaddikim, who are more powerful than your average human being are able then to take upon themselves the suffering, which then cleanses the world step by step, and they become more powerful by receiving that suffering, which then makes them more powerful cleanser at the same time, and then slowly the corruption is cleansed. That, though, just thinking back to Javi's question, that is balanced with the negativity that people are participating in also regularly. I mean, if you look around us, not only Jews, but non-Jews as well are participating in extreme negativity these days, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Whether it's dishonesty, whether it's Gilui Arayos, whether it's Lashon Hara, whether it's lack of recognition of Hashem in the world, whatever it is, there's so many different areas in which individuals and groups are participating in concealing the light of Hashem in the world, that it really takes quite a bit, and it really puts a lot on the shoulders of those who are working to reveal the light of Hashem in the world. And that could be one reason why this is a very challenged generation, even though we have it so cushy. You know, we have so much at our disposal, so much, again, food and climate control and clothing and comfort and cars and whatever, so much that makes our life so easy. And yet each one of us, it seems, is really suffering so much from the inside. You know, each family has marital trouble or has financial trouble. Even when we make a lot, we could still be burdened by tremendous debt and not figure out where things are going. And food trouble. Even though we have so much food, we could have so many food sensitivities. Look at all the gluten-free people today, you know, who are struggling so much with food. And that's just gluten. There's so many other food sensitivities, too. Learning issues and health issues. And just every family has more than one significant issue that it's contending with. When I was a young mom, I looked out over my community in Long Beach, and I just thought there must be something in the water in Long Beach, that every family was struggling so much. We all had kids with ADD. We all had kids with learning issues. We all had kids with health issues. It was just like crazy. I really did think there was Long Island has well water instead of it's its own water system. So I was just wondering, like, is there something poisonous in the water here? Look what's going on with all these families. It was really crazy. But I realized as I've grown up that it was not just Long Beach and it was not just my group of friends. It's everybody. Everybody has stuff. So our Rav here in Denver a few years ago, our previous Rav in Denver, did speak about the suffering that everybody's experiencing. And he said that every generation, for various reasons, does need to experience suffering. And Baruch Hashem, our suffering in this generation is not exile. It's not being scattered from place to place and chased from place to place. It's not pogroms. It's not the Inquisition. But it's suffering from inside, that every family has their share of suffering from that's coming from inside their home instead of coming from outside their home, but that the suffering is still there, coming in different ways. So I guess we should end it on a cheery note instead of a depressing note. So it's interesting, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, because we were celebrating Lag BaOmer this week, he actually said about himself that he had the spiritual strength to be metaken the world through his stature and receiving suffering. I only read that about him and didn't read why he didn't. But it's interesting to think about the concept of a person having that level of strength. I think some people, Moshe Rabbeinu included, were held back from that expression of their strength because it wasn't appropriate for the people at the time. So that would have to do with the growth that we haven't yet achieved. I did just learn this week from Esther Wien something fascinating. She talks about the quality of holding back and how, as Gvura, the quality of holding back, how that is a principal quality of Hashem as well, and that we can emulate Hashem in that. And she just pointed out, you know, if you would take whatever, and I have somebody next to me taking notes, if you take that person's pen and release the energy that's in the atoms at the tip of the pen, it would level this entire area, probably the whole Denver, right? Because there's so much energy in those few atoms at the tip of that pen that the release of that energy would destroy everything in our area, right? So, but she's writing with the pen instead. Because Hashem is holding back the energy that's inside those atoms. So Hashem holds back a tremendous amount of energy so that the world can continue to function. So it's just interesting to think about the living in the tension of opposites concept of the strength and the necessity of the holding back at the same time that we're pushing forward and needing to make both work at the same time. So Lag BaOmer is a time when we think about it. It's the time that we turn the tide in Sphira. We end the period of mourning and move into the period of, really, Sphira Omer should be a period of Simcha. It's like Chol Moed between Pesach and Shavuos. So we lift the period of mourning on Lag BaOmer. We make that turn. It's right after the heart of the Omer. Lev BaOmer is the heart. The day before Lag BaOmer, and with the good heart, we're able to turn the tide and move forward, hopefully connecting to each other and building towards Shavuos. So I'll end on that positive note instead. If anybody has any questions, this is your chance.
How would you classify a tzaddik? Because if you're thinking about suffering and people suffering from the inside, and one really doesn't know who would be classified and who not.
Right. You don't know, and fortunately, we don't actually have to know. But Hashem is the one who really knows who are tzaddikim and who are not. Some people we can take guesses at ourselves because we see people who behave in consonance with Torah principles with such strength that, and other people see it too, that through community agreement we can point out some tzaddikim. But we don't really know because we don't know the background that they come from, what they've overcome. I mean, there are some people who are tzaddikim. They don't even know they're tzaddikim because they don't even know what they've overcome in their lives. I mean, I worked with one person. I used to give a shiur in a city that I lived in. And a person came to it regularly for years. And I was a younger mom then. There were some young moms in the shiur, although there were older ones too. But one thing that we regularly talked about was keeping our voice low, speaking calmly. But speaking calmly repels anger. And we went over this in so many different iterations. And I saw that person who was regularly coming for years was constantly yelling at her kids. I just couldn't believe it. Like after the years and years of discussion of the importance of Koach HaDibur and speech and calm and all that stuff, how much she yelled at them in front of me. I just couldn't believe it until one day, and I was busy condemning her inside my head, of course, not saying it out loud, but I was busy thinking, like, she hasn't listened to a word I've said. Not one word. She did not get it. And then I met her mother. Her mother was a maniac. I mean, she screamed constantly. Once I met her mother, I realized, oh my gosh, this person has made so much progress. It's unbelievable how calm she is compared to her mother. You know, and I realized that I was judging completely inappropriately because I didn't know where she was coming from. And we judge ourselves. Also, we think we have permission to judge ourselves. We don't, because we don't even know. We don't know previous stuff. We don't know all the things that are inside us. We don't know all the impacts that are on us. So we can't decide who's a tzaddik and who's not, where somebody's coming from, what they've accomplished, what they've achieved, how much that they are bending their nature to serve Hashem, and what level they've achieved by the work that they've done. So it's not for us to judge who's a tzaddik, but a tzaddik, a general definition of tzaddik is somebody who lives their life in total consonance with the principles of the Torah. So keeping mitzvahs, not doing averas, that's considered tzaddik. Chassid is a level higher. Somebody who tries to achieve more, but tzaddik is righteous. Right? So tzaddik is somebody who lives in that balance of righteousness, of correctness, correct behavior in pretty much all circumstances. We have the principle from Mishlei, Ein Tzadik Ba'aretz Asher Lo Yechteh. There's no such thing as a tzaddik who doesn't sin. So even a tzaddik could make a mistake. But in general, their life is led in consonance with Torah and mitzvahs. So that would be a thought about what a tzaddik could be. But it's very subtle in most cases, I would think. I mean, one concept why Hashem calls Moshe Anav is because Moshe was such an Anav that even he didn't know he was such an Anav. So he couldn't have said that about himself, Moshe, when he, Hashem, when he is talking to Miriam about how could she speak Lashon Hara against Moshe. Doesn't she realize who he actually is? That she didn't realize the level that he had achieved, because even Moshe didn't know the level that he had achieved, because he was so unup, he didn't even know that level. So that could be a definition. It's not a definition, a thought on Tzaddik, and we don't have to actually know. But just it's a principle to know that a Tzaddik can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
We can't always see Tzaddik, but what we can see often is, not always, but often, we could see somebody who is achieving more than we're achieving. If we know ourselves well, we could maybe find somebody to attach ourselves to or learn from who's above us. And even if we don't find somebody who's above us, we could usually find a group that embodies that which we want to strive towards. So that each person in the group, maybe one person in the group isn't a tzaddik, but as a group together, let's say a congregation or a community, one person in the community is strong in chesed, and another is strong in shmiras lashon, and another is strong in shmiras einayim, and another is strong in tznius, and together they make the tzaddik that we'd like to attach ourselves to.
Right.
So on that, please email questions if you have, but I better go because I have another class to teach in 4 minutes. I have to find the room still. So I wish you a good week, and have you go back to sleep, and I look forward to talking to you next week, Bezat Hashem.
Thank you, Elisa.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night.